And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning, and you're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show. How are you all keeping this fine Wednesday morning? It's 3 minutes past nine on this Wednesday, the 29th of October, 2025, just 2 days away from Halloween. And we have another bumper 3 hours for you to keep you informed and entertained. We've got all the news stories, local, national and beyond. We've got nice interviews that you will enjoy, hopefully, and your views and comments. And we invite them into us via the usual means. It's 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and text number, 086 60 25,000. And you can send your voice notes to that WhatsApp number if you want as well. You can always give us a call if that's your fave. It's 07491 25,000, Caroline, or in the hot seat as always, assisted by Katie today. And if you want to email, it's comments at highlandradio.com. And don't forget to watch the show if you can, if you want to. If you're at home and have access to your smart TV, your Fire Stick, open the YouTube app and just type in Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch the whole show there every day, all day. And we're also on Facebook and on the X platform. The Finn Valley Voice, childhood obesity is an urgent is as urgent a problem in the Finn Valley as it is elsewhere. Now, a new multi-euro initiative, cooperation and working together, is set to tackle that problem head on. The core project will invest almost 9 million in border areas to tackle obesity. Some 9,000 people will be empowered to tackle obesity by changing the behaviour, primarily by improving diet and increasing physical activity. And we chatted to one of the guys behind that a couple of weeks ago, and it's an interesting project, and hopefully we'll get results, especially in this age of the Ozempic age, you know, whereby, you know, if you really want to, you have access to, and you can afford it, access to ways of handily, in inverted commas, losing the weight. But that's a more traditional way of doing so as well there. On to the Nationals now, and Fianna Fáil figures believe Taoiseach Micheál Martin is facing a more serious risk of a challenge in his leadership than on previous occasions in the wake of the party's presidential election debacle. This is in the Irish Times. Sources across the party, from backbenchers to ministers, say Mr. Martin will have to negotiate an ongoing series of issues against the backdrop of heightening risk of a heave. There is a belief among some at a senior level, although not universal, that Mr. Martin's enemies in the parliamentary party may have 12 votes necessary to put down a motion of no confidence in the leader, but not necessarily to win it thereafter. Now, what's going to happen, or what probably is likely to happen here, is you will have, you know, backbenchers in their constituencies or in their counties calling meetings of Fianna Fáil folk, you know, the grassroots councillors, maybe senior reps within the party, and they'll chair a meeting, I'd imagine, and say, you know, what is the story here? What do you think of the direction of the party? What do you think of the leadership of the party? And I would say they'll be guided by it. Now, I'm sure that's going to happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen in Donegal. I don't know one way or other, but it's going to happen around the country, right? And, you know, these backbenchers, they don't do a solo run. They're going to make sure they've polled the people important to them in the party. And the thing about that process is Micheál Martin will get wind of that, of course, and then he has to decide. And I think there is an article in the one of the papers that we don't get. It's the Cork-based paper, The Examiner, isn't it? Whereby he said he will stay on, he will resist any heave, he will be tarnished during 2 years' time. So he, at this point, is saying, no, you know, it doesn't matter what's going on. But that being said, if he gets wind of a series of meetings in constituencies around the country whereby not just backbenchers, but rank and file, councillors, etc., are saying, right, OK, we need a different direction, he will have to make a decision. And I have a feeling he'll want to make that decision himself. But we shall see. We shall see. I just think things will move quite quickly in that regard. I would not bet on Micheál Martin being the leader of Fianna Fáil by Christmas, for an example. But again, the on the ground sense might be that, you know, he's doing a good job and the backbenchers aren't going to necessarily break away from what the feeling on their own ground is. Anyway, let's read on here. Where did I pick up from? Yeah, the timing of such a move, a vote of no confidence, that is, if it comes, may depend on a bad run of polling or a range of other issues which could destabilise the Taoiseach further. I think it is more serious than previous attempts, said one minister. Let's go to the Irish Independent now. And how many people would you say opted out of the organ donation scheme, right? So there's millions and millions of people in this country, of course. And there was quite a push on, and we got quite a lot of texts from people saying, I'm opting out. You know, I don't want to be donating by default. Well, the number that have opted out is, I suppose it's high, but it's low. It's 55,000. Which is far more than haven't, or sorry, far less than haven't. So more than 55,000 people have formally registered their objection to being considered as organ donors when they die, new figures reveal. Since the middle of June, new legislation means that when a person dies, it can be assumed they wish to donate their organs to be offered for transplant or another patient or to another patient, but they are entitled to indicate their objection. The HSE set up an opt-out register for those who do not wish to become organ donors, and up to the end of September, 55,241 of you had signed it to say they did not want to be considered donors when they die. From mid-June to the end of June, 40,888 people joined the opt-out register, followed by another 10,858 in July. The number of people joining fell to 2,738 in August and to 757 for most of last month. So I would say it tails off. I would say there's quite a number of people who says, right, I'm going to opt out, and then sort of the days run into weeks and weeks run into months and they haven't. And you know, I'm not trying to encourage it, but inevitably people will be reminded by me reading this article today and probably do it. I wouldn't be surprised. No, I'm going to stick on it, I think. If I can help anyone else in the past, you know, I can't take anything with me, can I? if the truth be told. So what difference it make if I'm dead? On to the Irish Daily Mail now. And Europe accuses Ireland of being soft on hate speech. Would you have imagined we're soft on hate speech? A new report by the Council of Europe that found hate speech is widespread in Ireland has put fresh pressure on the government to bring forward legislation. Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan previously ruled out introducing controversial hate speech laws after plans were shelved by previous minister Fine Gael's Helen McEntee following opposition from the government TDs and from the public, if the truth be told. Mr O'Callaghan has stood firm on the issue despite the threat of legal action from the EU if Ireland does not enforce European laws on hate speech. Yesterday, the Council of Europe's anti-racism body, the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, claimed the measure was necessary on hate speech because it remains widespread in the Republic. It called on Ireland to adopt legislation measures aimed at specifying and clearly defining in criminal law expressions of hate speech that are subject to criminal liability, in particular incitement to hatred, violence or discrimination, anti-immigration rhetoric was of particular concern to the report's authors. So this could be back on the agenda again. I think some of the problem with this legislation is that I don't think anyone really wants people to be hated just for the sake of being hated or to be have to endure hate speech. The problem here is that people wish to be able to express a genuinely held point of view or something that aligns with the way that they think, that if they did express that view, it would not be seen as hate speech. So it wouldn't be designed to target a group or hate on a group. But then again, you have to sort of categorize who are the groups. You know, what are the groups as well? And none of that was decided. When the conversation was being had in this country, it was like you couldn't say anything about anyone or else you'd be classed or it would be classed as hate speech. That went up the line and ministers realized that this was a hiding to nothing. But if they are going to do it, they'll want to do it relatively early in government so that people get used to it, in inverted commas, by the time the next election rolls around. We shall see, but Europe putting the pressure on Ireland. The Irish Daily Mail, Gaza's fragile ceasefire was on the brink of collapse last night after Israel launched fresh attacks on the Strip and aimed amid claims Hamas breached the deal. Health chiefs in the territory said at least two Palestinians were killed as the sound of tank fire and explosions rang out and locals were braced for more raids. Benjamin Netanyahu accused Hamas of violating the peace accord by claiming a coffin handed over on Monday contained the wrong deceased hostage. It said the body parts belonged to another captive who was recovered earlier. And the difficulty here is that, before we move on to the difficulty, it's actually 33 people that were killed and one IDF soldier was shot. But, I mean, how they are, I presume, I would hope, they're trying to return hostages, but obviously they have to dig through rubble, and that's difficult to do under the threat of airstrike. Donald Trump says nothing is going to break this ceasefire. He's presumably going to let Hamas do what he deems a proportional response and then say, right, lads, enough is enough. Another question, how many women would you say are in prison? It's a record number, 2,000, 3,000, 800. It's 301, and that is a record number. A record number of female prisoners are currently jailed in Ireland, and the figure is expected to increase in the coming months. Last Monday, there were 301 females in custody between the Dúchas Centre in Mountjoy and the Limerick Women's Prison, the largest number on record. There were also a further 124 female prisoners out on temporary release because of overcrowding in both jails. The latest data from the Irish Prison Service showed there were 219 prisoners in the Mountjoy Women's Prison, with 33 of them sleeping on mattresses. The prison is currently running at 150% over capacity. Clearly not enough space there. And good news for fans of President Michael D. Higgins, and I'd hope people who actually aren't fans of his. He's back in the Irish. He's back in Irish and Erdogan yesterday after receiving treatment for an infection. The 84-year-old was treated in St. James Hospital, Dublin. A spokesperson said President Higgins would like to express the thanks to the medical staff who treated him and to all those members of the public who sent their best wishes to him over the course of his brief stay in hospital. President Higgins travelled to the hospital by arrangement on Sunday and stayed in to receive treatment for two nights. I think he got intravenous antibiotics, but he's out and back at his desk, we are told. Brilliant news, actually, from the sporting world, and it's not the fact that Brendan Rodgers has gone from Celtic, although some might see that as brilliant news. Martin O'Neill's in his place, by the way. They're 8 points behind Hearts. You know, you can't finish third in a two-horse race, and that's unfortunately what Celtic are in danger of doing. It'll be interesting to see if he can turn that season around. But the actual good news is Ireland are through. Abby Larkin hailed Ireland for never giving up, and Katie McCabe got the drinks in as the girls in green booked their World Cup qualifying spot in League A, an amazing achievement. After Carla Ward's side fell 2-0 behind to Belgium by half-time, Crystal Palace star Larkin came off the bench to net a last-minute aggregate clincher that had them celebrating despite defeat on the night. It was a huge goal, a huge result for the ladies, and they are now have booked their World Cup qualifying spot in League A. Brilliant, brilliant achievement. 086 60 25,000, if there's anything in there you want to comment on, or if there's an issue you wish to raise, maybe it's something in your life that you need our assistance, something in your community, a group that you're part of, maybe something positive's happened to you, you want to spread some good news, maybe there's been a great local achievement, anything at all, the numbers are there for you. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts, or that telephone number for you, 07491 25,000. Seamus Dooley is NUJ Assistant General Secretary. He joins me on the programme now. Good morning, Seamus. Thank you for your time.
Hey, good morning. Good morning.
Right. People would know that the old sort of system, the old meetings, the partnerships between the council and the Gardaí have changed, and we have new policing committees. But there is concerns about, I suppose, public access, because when you talk about restricting journalism or journalists from access, you're restricting the public from access. So what is proposed and what are the concerns?
Yeah, I suppose first thing to say is that the policing committees, as we know them, are gone, and they've now been reformed as local community safety partnerships. And the significance of that is that they're a wider base involving HSE and TUSLA, as well as local authorities and councillors. TDs will no longer attend. That's a minor change in some respects. But the minister announced in June that this was a new transparent approach to community safety, more inclusive. And then last week, the regulations were issued, recommendations to each of these joint partnerships. And bizarrely, it included a clause which said that under 10-4 simply said that it raised the possibility of media attendance, and it made provision for the discretion as to whether the media attend. And if media are to attend, they need to make a request to the chair. Up to now, there's been a presumption that journalists could attend. But then, bizarrely, in my view, it went on to say that for the first year, it's recommended that in order to allow things to bed down and allow the partnerships to develop their plans, that the media should be excluded, and that at the end of the year, there's six meetings a year, and that you should consider allowing media to three of them. So that's the long answer.
Yeah, but it makes no sense at all, because you could have a situation whereby a councillor steps out of that meeting and does an interview with their interpretation of it. A resident could head out of that meeting and post a blog on social media, and you have journalists sitting at home, sitting on their hands. I don't see any logic to it at all.
No, I think there are a few issues there. I mean, first of all, rewind the intention. This is not some sort of private quangle. This is a partnership made up of experienced community leaders who are put forward for this, police who are very experienced there because of their seniority, and then organisations like HSE and Tusla, the importance of which we clearly don't need to explain to your listeners. And they are there acting in the public interest. The notion that that they should communicate decisions is dealt with by saying that after private meetings, there would be an agreed statement. Well, agreed by who? Drafted by who? So that doesn't make sense. I also think that if you're talking about, and I've no reason to doubt the minister's sincerity on this, that you are talking about something which has buy-in, then you and I both know that the way you actually encourage people to take ownership of a project is that actually they know about it and that they've been part of it. Exclusion is a guarantee of rumour, of speculation. And there's a particular concern, I think, to say that while we make our plans in year one, we'll exclude the media, but we might let them in year two and three. I would have thought that the more logical way to get community support for this initiative and citizen support would be to have public access and shine a light while the plans are being developed, rather than deciding that you might let the media in year two or three. It very much reminiscent of the old-style Yes Minister approach to freedom of information, which is famously advocated by Jim Hacker. I don't think that Jim O'Callaghan is Jim Hacker, but I think he needs to look at this. I suspect that not a lot of thought has gone into it. I think it's a departure from the principle of transparency, and it drags us back to the old days. 40 years ago, I was a regional newspaper editor and reporter, where councils regularly went into committee and made decisions in private. I thought we had moved away from that. This seems to be dragging us back to those days.
Yeah, those are very frustrating days, it has to be said. And especially in this day and age where, there is greater, I think, more sort of inquisitiveness or intrigue from the public on matters that deal with Angada Síochána. Policing is a big issue up here. The way the HSE can impose decisions rather than, than being done through, in a public way. That's how people can feel sometimes. There's question marks over Tusa as well. It just, it really just will make the public go, well, what's going on here? It's really, more suspicious and damage the organisations I've just referenced more than they are already, potentially.
Well, yeah, I think what's important is that there are undoubted times when it is appropriate to have a private conversation. And Oireachtas committees, for instance, go into private session before or after their public hearings. Local authorities do the same. And I think I can imagine there are circumstances where the HSE or Tusla, for instance, or indeed police, may wish to give a briefing to the committee in private. That can be dealt with. There is no issue there. Mm-hmm. There should, however, be a presumption that meetings will be held in public, And this report suggests that the meetings will, there is a presumption that meetings will be held in private. The very notion that it is discretionary means that in theory, the community, the partnerships could decide that they're going to have all of their meetings in private for the entire term of office. That would be perfectly consistent with the guidelines now published.
Okay, we'll watch on. What happens from here? Obviously, the NUJ making their representations. Have you had any feedback from the minister? Or?
Well, I only wrote this. This emerged yesterday, and I think one point I would make is that government, through Commissioner Naman, are actually funding a local democracy scheme to encourage greater coverage of local authority and community and regional government bodies. So there's an irony in this. This runs contrary to that. The story first appeared in the Journal, to give the Journal their credit, and that story was written by a democracy reporter funded by the Commission reporting scheme. In theory, that reporter might be excluded from meetings of the Partnership Committee. We have written to the Minister. I've also asked Local Ireland, which represents the regional newspaper titles and Newsbrands Ireland, to make representations on behalf of the print industry. I would also be talking to representative body of regional radio stations. And when the Dáil resumes next week, we will hope that this will be raised on the order of business. I've been contacted by a number of regional newspaper journalists in particular about this issue. It is of concern to regional journalists, to newspapers, to radio stations. But this isn't about journalists just wanting to stick their nose in or being nosy. Perfectly legitimate activity. But it is actually about the ownership of public bodies by the taxpayer. You know, I don't believe that the members of these partnership bodies need the protection of the chair or some sort of secrecy provision. They are experienced public officials. They are having discussions in the public interest. They should take place in public.
Okay, Seamus, thank you very much for your time. Seamus Dooley, NUJ Assistant General Secretary. A few of you texting in on organ donation. A caller says, I've always wondered if someone in their 70s passes away suddenly, is someone of that age's organ any good for donation, or is organ donation only for people under a certain age? I'm older now and often thought about organ donation, but just wondering if my organs are too old. Well, my understanding is that it's not about the person's age, it's about the condition of the organ. And there are cases that I've read in the past of people in their 90s that have donated organs. I'm not sure if it's the exception or the rule, but it's about the condition of the organ. And, you know, I think if it's a match and it's in reasonable condition and it might save somebody else's life, you kind of wouldn't cherry pick, would you? But there is no age. It's about the condition of the organ rather than the age of the person that might be donating it. You could have a perfectly healthy kidney, for an example, I presume. One of the most selfless acts in a time of deep grief is to give the gift of life to another person. Please donate your or your loved one's organs and give someone else a chance to live. I'd be curious as to why. You see, there are people of a certain political persuasion, because, and I'm only saying this is because these are the spaces that I heard it from, that were discouraging people from giving their their organs because it was like the government taking ownership of them, right? So but really, you know, I've been in an emergency department where a doctor approaches you and asks you this question. You know, it's not Micheál Martin or Simon Harris there. These are our medical professionals on a ward at a time saying, look, what do you think? What was the deceased person's wishes, etc., right? So, you know, this idea that Dara O'Brien's in there trying to rip the organ out of someone is not. I trust the medical professionals and it's they that's in charge of it. But 55,000 people did. And I would really be curious to wonder why you did. And I'm asking it out of curiosity because I'm not motivated to opt out. And I probably wouldn't be, if the truth be told, because as I say, once I'm dead, I'm dead, and I'm more interested in whether I'm going to be buried or be cremated rather than whether I'm, you know, some parts of me are extracted to help somebody else. But if you did opt out, why did you opt out? Genuinely, and it's as I say, it's a curiosity. It's not to challenge it or question it. It's a personal decision. It's your body. Whatever you do with it, right? That's up to you. But why, if you did opt out, did you opt out? WhatsApp 086 60 25000 and let us know if you want to, of course. Our next topic, I mean, are we completely losing the run of ourselves, or is this an appropriate move? We'll put it to you, the listener. Students at the University of Sheffield have, we're told, been given a trigger warning about themes of violence and murder in the Bible pertaining to Christ's crucifixion. English literature students have been issued with a content notice advising them that the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John contain graphic bodily injury and sexual violence. Roger Kiska is legal counsel for the Christian Legal Centre, and he's with me now. Good morning to you, Roger. Thank you so much for your time.
Good morning. Pleasure to be on with you.
This just seems to me really bizarre, but I'm open to be sort of influenced on it. You know, I've never really considered it, and I never thought I had to, but yet here we are. What's your view, Roger?
I mean, my view, I mean, it's a multifaceted view, but at the very base, you look at other parts of culture. Like, we have LGBT and transgender cartoon being, you know, shown in primary school. Do we put trigger warnings on that? We have violence in the Quran. Do we put trigger warnings on that? Why Christianity? We have rap songs which glorify violence demeaning women. We don't put trigger warnings on that. So I think the decision makers need to own their own prejudices. They need to show the same level of tolerance that they demand of everyone else for the things they hold sacred. And we need to figure out how education has gotten into such a position that we have young adults who need trigger warnings for the scriptures and the redemptive message of Christ on the cross.
Yeah, one thing, and listen, I haven't read the Bible back to back, right? But obviously been exposed to it throughout my life. I don't reference any sexual violence as part of the crucifixion story. Sorry, I don't remember any sexual violence as part of the crucifixion story. That seems to be like a narrative that's being applied here.
There's absolutely no sexual violence. I mean, it's absurd to even suggest that. And they should read the Gospels before they put a trigger warning on it. You know, perhaps they watched the Mel Gibson movie, and that's where they've got this idea of gore. The Gospels are beautiful. My old professor of theology learned Greek as an atheist, reading the Gospel of John and translating that, and became a believer just from that. There's a powerful redemptive message. It gives meaning to a society which is searching for it, and we shouldn't be providing trigger warnings for it, plain and simple.
It's just, I just do wonder, you know, the generations that are coming through, if the trigger warning is there supposedly because some students might find such details difficult. This is historical information. It's been around for years. I do wonder, and I've had concerns about, you know, raising children into young adults and their ability to deal with the realities of life and what have you. If this is just going down a very dodgy road. You know, resilience is a big problem already. And what is this saying is if we feel that fully grown adults, young adults, be that, can't negotiate this story?
I would honestly say probably look at the Instagram feeds of any number one of these young adults and tell me that what they have in those feeds isn't worse than what's in the scripture, you know, minus the salvific message there and the message of God loves you and would have his only son die for your sins. I question that too, how we can get to university and not even be able to read that. You look at the Greek and the Roman classics, they're filled with, you know, violence, whether it's Homer or you know, any of the classics. You know, why is this any different other than that there's a cultural prejudice and intolerance towards Christianity?
Well, I want to tease that out with you a little bit more, but just to frame this even further from my perspective, to be honest with you, and I could be talking about anything. It's not just because it is the Bible, but I would be astonished if not every single one of these students who's on X didn't see Charlie Kirk being assassinated live, effectively. Do you know what I mean? Or
yeah,
exposed to that.
Absolutely.
For example, you can't tell me that they didn't. And also, I would be concerned if anyone who is wouldn't know basically what you're likely to see in the Bible, the same as, you know, even a Christian might have some sense of what's in the Quran. Like, for instance, I don't want to pick on any other religions, but there are themes in other religious works that are really, really quite troubling, if you know what I mean. But why Christianity then? And I'll just ask you to suppose on that, because you talked about sort of maybe policing or what have you. Why do you believe these trigger warnings are based on this book?
Well, I do think there's an, you know, there's a cultural prejudice, an intolerance and discrimination towards Christianity that's accepted because it's an easy punching bag. So it allows us to protect every other sacred cow in culture by saying, well, look, I mean, we are saying that there is problems. We're, you know, the Gospels are remarkable in that we get to see the suffering of Christ on the cross, and that is his expression of love for us and that message. And I think it goes part and parcel with the Gospels. You can't have the Gospels without the crucifixion. I mean, that is our salvation.
So is the, you know, sometimes, and it's not just in terms of Christianity, you see it elsewhere, are we overreaching to say that this is sort of part of a very subtle potential attack on Christianity, in that over time it creates this, maybe it creates this story that Christianity is based on violence and fear, and, you know, that it's those that follow it are in some way that way inclined. You know, is it like death by a thousand cuts, if you know what I mean? Is this a subtle attack on Christianity? Is that how you would see it?
Yeah, I mean, University of Sheffield, first of all, is pretty notorious for anti-Christian behavior. So Felix Nagoli had his case there, and he's in another case right now at the Court of Employment Appeal Tribunal today. So he was removed from his studies there for quoting scripture about homosexuality and same-sex marriage debate. They said, you're not fit to be a social work student because you hold these beliefs. And it took the Court of Appeal to say, look, holding and expressing a belief is protected. It's not discrimination. And now he's in another case, an employer who withdrew a job offer when they discovered his views on, you know, those social media posts. And it's created a litmus test saying, if you're Christian and believe these things, you're not allowed to work in certain professions. I think it's very dangerous. It's very undemocratic, and it shouldn't be in Europe at all.
Right, okay. Well, I hope these students don't listen to Sabrina Carpenter's latest single, or they'll never recover. they might not survive that at all. Okay, listen, it's an interesting story. Thanks very much indeed for that. That's Roger Kiska, legal counsel for the Christian Legal Centre. So students at the University of Sheffield have been given a trigger warning about themes of violence and murder in the Bible, mostly focused on Christ's crucifixion. And it talks of graphic bodily injury and sexual violence. And as I said, I don't recall in my exposure to it, sexual violence ever being a thing. But that was confirmed there by Roger Kiska. Now, in relation to, also, there was a couple of comments here that I wanted to that were today, because I've got other comments from yesterday. Policing, would the NUJ not be better off investigating the bias pro-establishment reporting from the media broadcasts in TV, radio and print? I think it reached new lows during recent elections. Okay. Another, politics in Ireland is a disgrace, really. Micheál Martin thinks we need a referendum to make sure everyone gets a docket, when he was actually the person imposing the whip which prevented it. People really are fooled by party politics nowadays. I feel sorry for the old Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael supporters. They say, have been betrayed. Sinead Dooley, Head of Public Engagement at Airgrid, talking ahead of an event that's taking place in Donegal in the not-too-distant future. But I suppose, just to be clear, if you could outline the role of Airgrid in terms of our energy infrastructure, energy conveyance, delivery, etc.
Yeah, first of all, delighted to be on air, to get the opportunity to outline our Energy Roadshow details and to speak to you a little bit about what it entails. So, look, Airgrid are a state agency. We're responsible for the delivery of large infrastructure projects. So we bring the electricity from where it is produced to where it is required. Sometimes we're confused with ESB networks. So I suppose the way that ESB and ourselves differentiate between the two is that we're the responsible for the electricity motorways, And they then take the electricity from those motorways and bring them into schools, businesses, farms, hospitals through the local roads network. So I suppose that's the easiest way to describe who AirGrid are and what we do, Greg.
And in terms of this roadshow that's coming to Donegal, I understand this is a part of a series of roadshows. What's the purpose of them and how significant is it, I suppose, going into the communities, so to speak?
It is, and I suppose this started back in 2022. We did a national consultation, AirGrid, around the future of energy in Ireland. And we heard from industry and communities, a lot of rural communities took part in those engagements and consultations. And it became evident listening to people that they are aware of the need to move away from fossil fuels as our main source of energy to a clean, green energy, from environment, climate action, and in terms of our air quality, Greg, to have that cleaner source of green energy. So people at those events had questions around putting solar panels on the roof of their sheds, around moving maybe from solid fuel cookers to heat pumps, and they wanted to know how they would do that and what it would cost. So AirGrid listened and decided to, why not bring all of the key stakeholders together to provide advice and support all in the one place? So that's what the Energy Roadshows are about. So we've been doing it since 2022, and indeed our first ever roadshow was in on the Maybank holiday weekend that year in Letterkenny. So we bring ESB Networks, Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, and then we're partnered with the local county council in the area. So Donegal Environment Office will be with us. So I suppose what the audience can expect on the night is to, first of all, come in early and meet with the Northwest Energy Agency and other exhibitors, who will be there outlining about renewable energies, solar panels, heat pumps. Speak to those experts. It'll be an opportunity to find out about what grants are available to you as an individual to move away from a solid fuel cooker, as they say, or to put those solar panels on your roof. It's an opportunity to speak and ask those questions. There'll also be a panel discussion, which thankfully you're going to compare on our behalf and facilitate, Greg. And it's where the audience will have an opportunity to hear from those experts. We will partake as well to outline a couple of projects that we currently have in the northwest of the country. And as I say, to ESB, Donegal Area Manager will be there to answer questions. And also Isabel, the local Sustainable Energy Communities Mentor in Donegal, will be there as well to speak to communities who have questions, as I say, to around what they can do to make their own homes more comfortable, to make their community halls more environmentally friendly. So it's a wide-ranging number of questions we usually get at these events. But as I say to you, it's an opportunity to ask the questions, hear from the experts, and find out the information that you require.
As you mentioned, with the players that will be there, AirGrid yourselves, the ESB Networks, the SEAI, and I suppose that, and you've already referenced this, the conversation about, you know, cleaner energy, our responsibility in terms of improving the climate, but people are also exposed to sort of, you know, global matters. You know, a lot of influence from America, drill baby drill, you know, cutting incentives for electric cars, you know, coal-fired stations being built in other part of the world, and then we feel like a little tiny island. Do you believe sort of that's sort of a temporary political sort of a blip? Do you think it will have any impact on trying to get that green energy, that climate message across to the people of Ireland?
Well, of course, with all of the noise in media globally at the moment and with everybody's easy access to social media, it's very difficult for people now, and I find myself, to differentiate between what's AI generated, what's reality anymore. And it's very difficult for people, as you say, to understand what difference can we, as a small island, have as an impact in terms of global change at that level. But I would say to people, bring it down to a local level. If the invasion by Russia in Ukraine taught us nothing else, it taught us the importance of having an independent, robust, resilient electricity supply to this island. And one of the ways in which we can do that is to bring more renewable green energy onto the grid. So when we speak of that, you're speaking of offshore renewable energy, which we're central to in Ireland at the moment, but also your solar panels that we see emerging in the country, your wind farms. Now, all of those renewable initiatives require a sustainable grid to to bring them, as I said to you, where the power's generation to where it is needed. So the only way that Ireland is going to insulate itself from future energy crisis is if we are in a position to have, as I say, our own independent renewable supply of energy. It will not only give us that security of supply and resilience, but it will also in time help us to drive down and be able to manage our costs better as well. So, look, I, like you, thought as well from a personal level, what difference does it make to me? And if we look at it in the global level, we seem small and insignificant. But, you know, I would say to people as well, bring it into your own homes. My parents moved away from fossil fuels onto to a heat pump last year because they're getting elderly, because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't what impact they were going to make on the global crisis. It was literally, how do I, as I move on in years, make my home more comfortable, warmer, and less about relying on fossil fuels and having to bring in your fossil fuels out of the shed. And it was about your home comfort, your quality of air. People have come back across the country and said that when they moved away from fossil fuels, they, you know, anybody with lung infections or with asthma and other lung-related illnesses have found a significant difference as well in their own health. So
there is a lack of knowledge actually out there as to what you're breathing in front of an open fire, because the focus is primarily about what goes out the chimney. But it's an interesting point you make. Often the point is made as well, and as you would know, we'd have a lot of turbines, wind turbines in Donegal, the northwest, for an example. But people would make the argument that we're not able to utilise that electricity. You know, we're not storing it well when the wind's blowing, and we don't have access to it when the wind is not blowing, or that, you know, we have difficulties with the network in terms of getting that power to homes and how much might be lost on the way. So what is the reality there in terms of how well we are utilising the green energy that we're creating at the moment? And if it's not where it needs to be, when will it be?
If I had the answer to when will it be, my role title would be a very different one, Greg. But joking aside, that is a factor. It is something that has been looked at again globally, not just in Ireland, because the ideal situation would be in terms of having large storage batteries. We're not at a fully developed stage in the country in that regard yet. So we have huge amounts of wind, and there are times when people will see that the turbines are not turning, and it's when, as you said, the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine, but also when there's too much wind that they have to be turned down for operational reasons. So, you know, that's an area that our control centre and AirGrid monitor on a daily basis. We are improving as a country in terms of finding new innovations around those large energy storage areas, but you know, we're certainly not utilising all of the energy that we currently have, but that is evolving as well as we look at new technologies coming on board and as we use look at better ways of using that energy. There's an initiative in Ireland at the moment that it's something that's kind of been piloted in urban centres, and it's something that ideally we'd like to see rolled out on a broader level. And it's where the excess energy is stored. There are meters on people's home. As I said, it's in large urban centres, obviously for operational reasons at the moment, in Dublin particularly, but that at night time, that excess energy is filtered into homes that have these meters, and that you wake up with a warm tank of water. So as I said, there's initiatives like that that are being looked at continually, and it's something that I do see that we will make huge improvements in new technologies and new innovations in the years to come.
I'm listening to you in terms of what might drive down electricity costs. And, you know, there's an awful lot of coverage at the moment about the wholesale price versus the retail price and what have you. And I know you talked of the fact that if we become more independent, we embrace green energy more, that might be maybe a way to close that gap. But the national commentary I've been hearing recently is not that that's how we're going to do it, but a further interconnector from Spain is how we're going to do it. Now, I'm not saying that's AirGrid's position, but that's what was being sort of framed, or how it was being framed on national media recently. Do you agree with that? Do you concur, or do you find it frustrating that perhaps maybe your message is not getting out there, and it's actually quite the opposite, that experts, in inverted commas, see our connection to other countries as the solution to meeting our power needs or, in fact, reducing power costs?
Look, I think that's a debate for a whole different day. And that's not abdicating. I mean, we have an interconnector that we're currently building between Ireland and France at the moment. I read the same media reports that you read in terms of looking at other interconnectors. Spain is one that's been mooted. But they're still developing a memorandum of understanding between two countries. So that's at a level that's quite removed from where we're currently at. Yes, it's something we will look to, obviously, in the future. But our immediate needs in this country and hitting our climate targets of 80% renewables by 2030 needs to be in the projects that we currently have on hand to deliver. We have over 400 projects on our books in Airgrid at the moment that are being delivered throughout Ireland. A lot of them are reinforcements of the grid, but many of them are the need for new circuits that we have currently looking at in Donegal and Sligo, and we have a public consultation open on that at the moment. You know, yes, there is a need between an interconnection between Ireland and Europe, and they are being explored. But I think that's where we lose people in the debate, and you're quite correct. So for us to try and get the immediate message out to people of the need to, you know, that reliable security of supply, that need to drive down costs, you know, we need to focus on the work at hand. So it's a pipeline of projects being done at the moment. We can only deliver those projects with the cooperation of landowners and communities, the length and breadth of Ireland. So as head of public engagement, that's my focus. I have a team of engagement specialists, of community liaison officers, of agriculture liaison officers who are 24/7 on a daily basis working with communities and landowners to try and get that message through that if we want electrification of our transport, if we want electrification of our heat system, if we want to be able to have a clean electricity when we flick a switch in this country, we need to build the infrastructure and we need the support of communities and landowners to do that.
And it is kind of interesting, and this is what will bring us back to the event, the Energy Citizens Roadshow in the Central Hotel Donegal Town on Thursday, November 6th from 6:15pm. You know, we'd speak to quite a lot of businesses on this programme or other programmes on Highland Radio, Sinead, and some of the most successful businesses are businesses that didn't necessarily have to be convinced into the benefits of solar or insulation or all that type of stuff. Is they actually saw the benefits of it and tied it into the business plan and are leading the way out on that. And I suppose it's really getting that mindset into the public's mind. You know, how does it benefit me? How does it make me my house warmer? You know, how can I also feel that I'm contributing to try and improve the environment for those that come behind me, the climate, etc., etc. So, you know, there are those that have got it already, and I suppose roadshows like this are trying to help others over the line.
Absolutely, and you've put it very well there, Greg. And I mean, that is the whole thought process behind bringing this energy roadshow around the country, because, as I say to you, people were asking those questions and finding it difficult, I suppose, to find the answers to them on occasions. And a lot of them, unless you're IT savvy or indeed that you have a good broadband connection or a good satellite dish, it's difficult to find and manoeuvre your way towards finding out that information online. So that's exactly the thought process behind this. And as you say, you know, businesses are doing this. And indeed, I'm attending the Letterkenny Chamber of Commerce Awards on the 7th in Donegal. And there on that night, you will hear from a number of businesses who have embraced sustainability, who are looking at those cost-saving measures, who are introducing small initiatives on a daily basis to drive down their own operational costs and to do their part in terms of that environmental change. Look, I suppose it's like everything. It takes time for people's mindset to change. It takes time for us to introduce new policies. And if you look back, I mean, who would have thought 20 years ago or 25 years ago that smoking would be prohibited indoors in public houses and restaurants? Who would have thought that we'd be bringing our plastic bags, you know, that they'd be going out of introduction? We'd be paying to use a plastic bag. You'd be bringing sustainable bags with you when you went shopping. It's all a change of habit, a change of mindset, and in time we'll see the benefits to it. But it's something that we really clearly have to get the message out there to people using yourselves and local radio, and say this one-to-one contact with communities and business and landowners, that we really need to drive the message home, the personal benefits to people, and then collectively the impact that that will have on our environment.
All right, it's the Energy Citizens Roadshow. It's in the Central Hotel in Donegal Town on Thursday, November 6th, running from 6:15 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. For now, Sinead Dooley, Head of Public Engagement at Airgrid, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Greg, and look forward to seeing the people of Donegal at the event.